Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank everybody so much who downloads the podcast, who rates and reviews the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, who visits the podcast store at carasantamaria.com, and also those of you who have made donations to help support the podcast and keep it 100% free to download. So today, I want to give a shout out to Greg Rogers from Flora Hill in Victoria, Australia. Thank you so much for your donation. I want to thank Michael Rogers for his recurring donation. Thank you so much for that. I also want to thank Patrick Keller from Hudson, Wisconsin. And lastly, I want to thank Rick Richardson, as always, from Elma, Washington. Thank you so much for your donation. Guys, I had the honor this week to travel to ApostaCon, which was held in Omaha, Nebraska. And this is a free thought convention. So it's a place where a lot of like-minded folks, atheists, agnostics, skeptics, secular humanists, free thinkers, all gather together to kind of talk about the issues that they face and to celebrate in their mutual love for the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And there was a great talk by Neil deGrasse Tyson. There was also a great talk by Lawrence Krauss. And if you notice last week, I attended 2 weeks ago. If you notice last week, I was able to air an interview with David Silverman, who is the president of American Atheists, and I recorded that while I was at ApostaCon. I also recorded an interview with Professor Lawrence Krauss. Now, he is a theoretical physicist and cosmologist. He's actually the foundation professor of the School of Earth and Space Exploration at Arizona State University. He's also the director of its Origins Project. And his most recent book is called A Universe from Nothing. Why There Is Something Rather Than Nothing. Now, he had a recent feature in Scientific American. The cover story says, A Beacon from the Big Bang, where he kind of explains the recent Bicep 2 finding and kind of explains a little bit more about gravitational wave theory. Now, those findings right now are currently under question. There is a good chance that some of the kind of interstellar dust that was picked up by the Bicep's recording apparatus could actually be mucking up the results, and what they think might be signatures from the early universe could actually just be noise from this dust within the Milky Way, and that is being sorted out right now. Dr. Krauss is hopeful that the Bicep 2 findings hold up. Now, like I said, I had a chance to sit down with him at ApostaCon. It was pretty late on Saturday when there was a big costume party, and I was only able to snag about 30 minutes of his time, and he was a couple drinks in at this point. But without further ado, I welcome this week's guest, Dr. Lawrence Krauss. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Lawrence. We are here at the ApostaCon conference. This is how I was able to corner you and convince you to sit down with me for Talk Nerdy.
Yes, that's right. That's what we'll say for the public.
Exactly. Okay. There you go. You were the keynote speaker here, and earlier today you spoke about a topic that I've heard you speak about before, that I've seen you write about a lot before.
Although a lot of it was new, I hope, because I just wrote it yesterday.
Well, you spoke about, well, I've heard you talk a bit about multiverse theory and about Something from Nothing, the themes that are in your book.
Yeah.
But I have the most recent copy of Scientific American here, and there's an article that you wrote in it about the Bicep 2 findings.
Sure, that's what I really, that was what motivated the talk, the idea that we could be changing our empirical picture of the universe by an amount that is uncomparable or in all of human history. So if it's right. And it may not be, and I'm willing to admit that, but it's if it's right, it changes our ability to talk with confidence about things that really we speculated about and and some of which I speculated about in my last book. And we can test those ideas now. And that, to me, is just amazing. I didn't even talk about some of the things you can test if this is true. It's really remarkable. And I'm hoping it's true. But as I said today, in science, hoping doesn't matter. Wanting doesn't matter. If it's wrong, it's wrong. We'll see.
So it's really late at night at this conference.
It is.
And there's been a lot of partying up until this point.
Yeah,
and
I am really
impressed with how coherent these answers are right now.
So far. It'll degrade quickly, but it's all smoke and mirrors.
So I had Sean Carroll on my podcast. He was one of my first guests. I've only been doing this for a few months. Uh-huh. And when we were podcasting, I interviewed both Sean and his wife, Jen Ouellette, in the same go. And I put Jen Ouellette's episode up first. So during the time between recording with Sean and airing his episode, he mentioned there's going to be a big announcement. Everybody who's in the know kind of knows about it, but it's not yet published, so I can't talk about it. And of course, then the announcement was made about the Bicep 2 finding.
I helped them make the announcement. I was very honored that they asked me to help them interpret their results. So I wrote a companion paper to their paper that appeared in Physics magazine, associated with Physical Review Letters.
Which is incredible because at the time, I just basically recorded an intro to that episode that said, so there's an experiment that's been going on for quite some time, and scientists think that they may have found evidence of gravitational waves. What that tells us is it gives us a picture of the earliest universe that we can see, and it tells us it tells us that what we think about inflationary theory is probably correct. Now, I can say those words. Uh-huh. I'm not sure how well I understand the words that I'm actually saying. And so that's really...
Too many straight lines in that sentence, but anyway. Okay.
And that's the big question, I think, for a lot of people is... Well, first of all, what is inflation? And second of all, what is Bicep 2 telling us?
Okay, well, that's partly why I wrote that long Scientific American article.
So let's summarize in 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Okay, well, the amazing thing is that there are puzzles of our universe that are pretty simple to understand, such as the fact that different distant ends of our universe, which we can just see now, clearly couldn't have communicated to each other in the time history of the standard Big Bang because they're farther apart than light could travel. Mm-hmm. Okay, if it can go from one end of the observable universe to us and the other end of the observable universe to us, it can't have crossed that whole chasm. But at the same time, when we look out, the universe is uniform in every direction. It's more or less identical. And that's a huge paradox because how does each end of the universe know to be the same as the other end? And that, among other problems, were solved by this wonderful, brilliant idea of Alan Guth in the 1980s, which wasn't designed to solve cosmological problems. It was designed, and what makes it kosher, if I can use that word on your program, is that it was designed because of particle physics, that it's quite likely that in the early universe there was a phase transition, and the phase transition happens when matter changes one state to another, like water freezing to ice.
Okay.
And when that happens, something called latent heat can be stored. And if you super cool water very quickly, it won't turn to ice. But when it turns to ice, it'll release a lot of energy. Because at low temperature, ice is the preferred state. At high temperature, water is the preferred state. Well, the same thing can happen for the universe. And what happens is if the universe gets stuck in this state, we call it a metastable state, it can store energy. Store energy literally in empty space. And as we know from looking at the universe now, where there's stored energy in empty space, that causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate.
Okay.
But Guth was thinking about something called grand unified theories, which was a scale which would occur if the three non-gravitational forces of nature became unified at a single scale, which was hypothesized for good reason to be something like 16 orders of magnitude smaller than the size of a proton. Okay, at that scale, the three forces of nature other than gravity, the strong, the weak, and electromagnetic force, would be unified in our picture. And there was every bit of indirect evidence that that should be the case. But when they separate, that's associated with a phase transition. The nature of the ground state of the universe changes. Early on, all the forces look the same, and later on, they look different.
That point where you said that they unify, this is at an incredibly small scale, at a very high energy scale.
Yeah, small scale, and that means you can only sort of probe it at high energy because of the quantum mechanics, which says you need more and more energy to probe smaller and smaller scales.
And
so when
you
think about the universe, that means early in the history of the universe, when the universe was hotter and smaller.
And much smaller. Okay, so when you're talking about them being different, being out of sync, you're talking about beyond that time.
Yeah.
After the Big Bang.
After the Big Bang, but very shortly after the Big Bang. A billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang.
Yeah, that's a very small amount of time.
Very small time. And but what Guth realized is that that phase transition that that is natural to occur in nature could result for a short time in this metastable state, storing energy. And if that's the case, it would cause the universe to puff up by a huge amount in a very short time. And Guth suddenly realized that that would solve all the problems of cosmology, because it would mean that our whole observable universe was once much smaller than we thought. And if it was once much smaller than we thought, there would have been time for all the distant parts of the universe to acclimate to each other, if you wish, and you get uniform. And then it got puffed up and they got pushed far apart. It would also solve other problems in nature, including something called the flatness problem, which at the time was the fact that the universe, a flat universe, is the boundary between an open and closed universe. It's the geometry of the universe in three dimensions can be in one of three different cases, open, closed, or flat. And a flat universe is the boundary. It's the universe we always thought we lived in, one in which the X, Y, and Z axis point in the same direction everywhere in space.
Okay.
And we were very close to a flat universe. If you measure the amount of the expansion rate of the universe and solve Einstein's equations and then measure the amount of matter, we were within a factor of 10 at that time of being flat. But the problem is, being a flat universe is like sitting on top of a mountain, a very pointy mountain. A slight push in one direction or another, if you're not exactly at the top of the mountain, you'll slide right down. And it turns out that's the case for a flat universe. If you're slightly more dense than a flat universe, you quickly become closed. If you're slightly less dense, you quickly become open. But our universe has been around for 14 billion years, and it's still close to being flat. And so that was called a flatness problem. And Guth recognized that, in fact, just like blowing up a balloon, if the universe puffs up at early times, it'll look flatter and flatter and flatter, just like the Earth looks flat in Kansas. And so all of these things were wonderful, but the problem is that there was no good model. The ideas were there, but we haven't had a really good model that explains inflation. But inflation also made another prediction, which is probably more important than any of the two, that it said that during the period in which the universe is puffing up, some very small quantum fluctuations get stretched out and eventually get turned into classical lumps, matter lumps, which would eventually collapse from galaxies and all the structures we see. And what was amazing was in the 1980s and 90s, as we observed what's called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which gives us a primordial picture of the universe when it was 300,000 years old, the nature of the lumps that we saw, the size of them, the intensity, all the rest, was precisely the kind of thing that inflation generically predicted. And that was remarkable. And that gave a lot more people confidence that inflation was correct. The next thing that led people to confidence that inflation was correct is that the universe actually is precisely flat, as far as we can tell. And that is pretty well only explicable if inflation made it that way. And people like me, theorists like me in the 1990s, before we'd even measured the universe being flat, had that prejudice that inflation was so, it sort of smelled right if you were a theorist.
Okay.
And it, even though it was an idea in search of a theory, there was no really good theory of inflation, I would say. But the idea was so beautiful that it seemed like it would be right. And so I and a colleague at Chicago argued in 1995 that it turns out if the universe is flat, then current observations at the time were inconsistent unless empty space had energy. Hmm. And we proposed that largely to point out that maybe something was wrong, not because we believed empty space is energy, but we argued that 70% of the energy of a flat universe would have to reside in empty space. And I don't know if anyone was more surprised than me when it turned out that that was actually right.
And so are you actually referring to dark energy?
Yeah, we predicted it. We argued that it had to be there if the universe was flat. And indeed, it is there. And it was a shock to me, even though I argued it had to be there. I argued it had to be there because I thought something else was wrong with the theory.
And is that one of, I mean, I had Catherine Friess on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and she mostly talked about dark matter, but we kind of brushed on dark energy. We didn't talk about it much, mostly because there is no evidence to support its existence.
No, that's not true. There's every bit of evidence to support existence. There's no theory. We don't understand it. It's the biggest mystery in nature. But a Nobel Prize was given because of its existence. The expansion of the universe is speeding up. And that's only possible if empty space has energy. If you put energy in empty space, it's gravitationally repulsive. And so the observed acceleration of the universe which in some sense I have to say we predicted, was observed in 1998, and the people who observed it won the Nobel Prize in 2011, I think. So there's a great deal of evidence that the energy of empty space exists. We just don't have the slightest understanding. It's totally unlike dark matter, which I studied for many years, mm-hmm. and we have many good possible candidates for dark matter, and yes. I've also invented and proposed many ways to look for it over the years. But that's much more easily understood. In fact, it's natural to have dark matter. It'd be very surprising if there weren't lots of dark matter in the universe. But dark energy is completely inexplicable. It's the biggest mystery in science.
And so when you say that we have evidence for it, what you're talking about is indirect evidence, that dark energy must exist in order for certain models to work.
Well, we can't measure in the laboratory, but that doesn't mean we don't have evidence for it. We knew atoms existed before we could see them.
Sure.
And the acceleration of the universe is, as far as we can tell, only explicable if there's dark matter energy. Much more than that. There's lots of different directions it all suggested. The flatness of the universe is only understandable. We can add up all the matter in the universe. It only accounts for 30% of the energy of a flat universe. 70% is missing. Mm-hmm. And then if you ask, well, if you put that 70% of the energy of the universe in dark energy, what would it do? Well, produce an acceleration of the universe, and it's precisely the acceleration we measure. So it's not as if there's just one bit of evidence. Every single line and the growth of structure, it's all consistent only with the universe with dark energy, which is why we've been driven to that remarkable and apparently not conservative assumption that the universe, that energy, empty space is energy. Let me point out what that really means. If you take a bit of space and you get rid of all the particles and all the radiation and everything, that empty space weighs something, and we don't understand why. It's for me the most exciting thing in science because it's totally inexplicable.
And is that something that you spend a lot of your time pondering?
I've pondered it for 20 years in one way or another. And we may spend 200 years before. It's going to take a long time to solve that mystery, precisely for the reason you indirectly mentioned, or maybe incorrectly mentioned, is that because we can't measure it directly in the laboratory, and the only evidence we have is cosmology, we can't really test very clearly what it is. And the most likely candidates are completely indistinguishable from an energy in empty space, literally a ground state energy from quantum mechanics. And so most of the reasonable alternatives look identical to that. Hmm. And the big question is, why does empty space have that energy? Not why did it have any energy, because in fact our theories predict it should have a huge amount of energy, 120 orders of magnitude larger than what we see. The big mystery is why it's so small, not why it's not zero. And the natural value we hoped it would be when I was a graduate student was zero, because that was the only mathematically pretty value. It turned out we were wrong. But all of our theories predict that quantum mechanics gives things what are called ground state energies. If we calculate those energies naively, we get a number which is way too large. So there's something fundamentally wrong with our theory. Mm-hmm. And if you're a theorist, there's nothing more exciting, as I like to say, than either being wrong or confused. And right now we're both, and that's really exciting.
And there's also a chance, going back to this conversation that we were having about BICEP2, there's a chance that these findings are aberrant, that you're actually measuring noise.
Well, the BICEP2 observations are possibly noise. Yeah, we'll know that within a few months. And it would be sad if it's the case, because various aspects of the signal mimic identically that of inflation, and they're consistent with noise, but they have all the characteristics of inflation. That would be kind of a sad, cruel joke if nature played where the fluctuations, where it went higher. See, inflation predicts that on certain scales the signal should be higher and on some other scales lower. And the data agrees with that exactly. But of course, there's uncertainties. And so a flat spectrum, which could be noise, could fluctuate up in one place and fluctuate down another. It would just be a sad and unfortunate accident, but nature can be cruel. If the up fluctuations were exactly where inflation would have predicted it to be up, and the down fluctuations are down, so we'll see.
But there is a chance that could be the case.
Oh, of course, there's a chance. And I'd have to say many of my colleagues are betting on that. I'm actually betting on the signal to be real, but...
Yeah, it did seem like at least in kind of the journalistic community, after the first excitement that really felt similar to when the Higgs was first measured, that pretty soon after that initial excitement, there was a big kind of bummer moment where a lot of people said, yeah, okay, I'm not sure we buy it
anymore.
Well,
it's because the reason was when they did the original observation and calculation, they didn't assume as much dust in our galaxy as a recent measurement, more made essentially after they did their measurement, suggests there might be. And that dust could provide a background. So it was reasonable that what they did. But, you know, scientists are skeptical, and that's what we're supposed to be. And so when people say, oh, it could be this much more mundane background rather than something exciting, most of us, because most of the time in nature, the exciting stuff is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're all prepared for the mundane explanation to be right. And we'll see.
We'll see which one it is. Yeah. And when we, and I mean, it's kind of like when the Higgs, I think, was first not first discovered, but actually physically discovered at the LHC. It was exciting. It was an exciting mundane discovery.
Well, yeah. Well, it wasn't mundane. I mean, it was remarkably exciting because it validated the greatest intellectual journey that we've taken in history.
But it does seem like most theoretical cosmologists expected it to be there.
Well, yeah, but it's exciting, but in a surprising way because. We expected, well, I actually didn't expect it to be there. I thought the Higgs was not there. I thought it was a too slimy an explanation.
Oh, interesting.
Too easy. I thought nature would be more inventive.
Huh.
I was kind of very surprised. But nevertheless, and it caused me to change my thinking, which I'm happy to say I can do. As a scientist, I've been trained to just throw out my ideas whether I like them or not if nature tells me otherwise. But it's also surprising another way because very few people expected to see just the Higgs.
Mm.
And seeing just the Higgs is almost more problematic than not seeing Higgs at all. And so, yeah, we expected the Higgs to be there. A lot of people expected the Higgs to be there because the simplest models predicted it. But just having a Higgs is really problematic because it doesn't explain why it's just a Higgs. Why does the Higgs field exist? Why did it settle in the state it did? None of those questions are answered. And most of the theoretical arguments we've come up with to try and answer them have suggested to be other particles. And we expected, in fact, to see those other particles before we saw the Higgs.
I guess,
and I think I was very surprised that we didn't see, say, supersymmetry before the Higgs.
But we're still on the hunt for those.
Well, happily, the Large Hadron Collider will turn on in another later in 2015, and then maybe we'll see, and it'll have more energy and more intensity, and maybe we'll discover all these particles, or maybe we won't. And in some sense, I'm voting for both because I like the idea that we're wrong because it means there's some new. I mean, we've been thinking about this for 40 years. We've been waiting for this accelerator for 40 years because the Congress was so stupid in the 1990s in this country that they canceled.
Yeah, we had one, right?
We had one that would have answered the question in 1995. But we not only did we cancel the project, but in Congress and their infinite wisdom, and boy, back then they were smarter than they are now. They not only said, well, it might cost $5 billion. That's too much money. So we spent $2 billion digging the hole. So let's cancel the project, but to make sure it never happens, let's spend another billion filling in the hole. And so it's unfortunate, but anyway.
It's also unfortunate because I think what you find is a voting public that has no comprehension of what we're even doing at the Large Hadron Collider. And granted, I'm not a physicist. I'm not a theoretical cosmologist at all. I'm a science communicator. My understanding is... I think a more top level understanding. It's obviously, I don't speak the language of mathematics that you speak, but I understand to some extent why it's so important. And I worry that people who are even listening to this podcast right now don't even understand the basics of the concept of taking a really large area and smashing together protons.
Well, that's why I write books like I do to try and get to explain people. And I have to say, I think to some extent that's why there's a greater appreciation for scientists communicating, because I think one of the reasons Congress killed the project was that scientists had been used to being funded because of the Cold War, and I don't think took seriously the notion that the taxpayer is paying the money and we have to explain why we're doing what we're doing. And so, I mean, that's not the only reason why I write books and
do
what I do.
But do you sometimes feel like you have a harder battle than maybe somebody who works in biomedical science, somebody who's got a really tangible outcome where they can say, we're doing this because we could save your life?
Maybe. I actually don't think so. I think the public finds this much sexier.
I think the public does find it sexier. Yeah. I wonder how much the public finds utility in it.
No,
unfortunately.
Not at all. They don't find utility at all, but they're desperately interested in it. In my institute, the Origins Project at ASU, we fill up 3,000 paying members of the public to come here science every year, twice a year, three times a year sometimes. People want to know this stuff. And the thing is that people are interested in it. They don't know they're interested. They don't realize that the questions they have are the questions that are really scientific questions. And so... I think people are fascinated by it, and ultimately, my point often is, and I say it a lot, that the real importance of science is not the technology it produces, but the ideas it produces. And I have to go in a minute, so let me end with a pretty soon in a because I have to go back and go dancing. But
your drink is almost empty there.
Yeah, I know. That's the other reason.
Terrible.
But Robert Wilson, who was the first director of the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory, was asked by Congress if, when they were building that accelerator, if it would help in the defense of the nation. And he said, no, but it'll help keep the nation worth defending. And I think that's the point. It's the ideas. If we stop asking questions about fundamental questions about where we come from and our place in the universe, then what kind of culture do we ultimately have? And when people say to me, what utility is it? I say, what utility is there in a Mozart symphony? What utility is there in a Picasso painting? People don't ask those questions for art or music or literature. But science, because of its technology, is assumed to always have a practical implication. But really, for me, the greatness of science is ultimately the ultimate purpose of the human endeavor, which is to re-examine our place in the cosmos and try and understand what that is. And ultimately, that's the great human journey that I enjoy being a part of.
Well, and I think that a lot of people don't realize that what science endeavors to do is to answer the same questions that people ask in a religious context, but it endeavors to do it using evidence.
Well, we endeavor to actually answer the questions instead of assuming the answer before you ask the question.
And when you ask somebody fundamental questions about who are we, why are we here, where are we going, blah, 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 ultimately, I think as you refine, you refine, you refine, it comes down to a question that I'm sure you get asked a lot, that most people shirk, that you wrote a whole book about, which is not so much what was before the Big Bang, but why did it happen? Why is there something rather than
nothing?
And then
I try and say why is not a good question. It's really how. Whenever you ask why, you really mean how. And the big miracle that that people really need to have explained is how can you get 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, if you had nothing to begin with? It seems to require divine intervention. And the reason I wrote the book is you don't need divine intervention. The laws of nature, as we understand them, allow that to happen. And if you ask what would be the characteristics of a universe that came from precisely nothing by known laws of physics, or by simple extrapolations of known laws of physics, the answer is those characteristics would be precisely the characteristics of the universe we see. Now, does that prove it? No, but it makes it plausible. And it seems to me we should celebrate that we don't need some Saddam Hussein in the sky in order to create everything.
Oh, he sounds terrible.
It does. Well, it is, I
think. Yeah, he really is. He's a vengeant fucker. And but I got to ask you, I know that you it's time to get back to the party, but these ideas that you wrote about in this book, they're very comforting to people like me and people like the folks that are at this convention, a lot of the people listening. They're probably incredibly frustrating for heavily religious people. I wonder about your colleagues.
Well, my colleagues are sometimes afraid of offending religious people, but I think that's really disingenuous. We should try and get people, look, they shouldn't offend anyone. As I often say, understanding how the universe should be a celebration for everybody.
Yeah, at a certain point, it's not my problem if it offends you. It's kind of your problem.
But I mean, I'd rather than offend people, and I don't mind offending some people. Some people deserve to be offended, but but I'd rather just get people excited and say the real universe is so amazing. You don't need all the garbage. And it may seem depressing to you to have a universe without any purpose, a universe for which you are not the center, which, after all, is an incredibly egotistical statement.
Oh, completely.
But think of it another way. I mean, if it's just all here as a cosmic accident, then it's even more precious that we arose by evolution and we have these brains that can allow us to ask these questions and appreciate with a consciousness the beauty of the universe. So instead of being embarrassed or upset by the fact that there's no purpose, we should just enjoy our brief moment in the sun. And I think if we talk to people that way and try and say, life is more precious, every moment is more precious if this is the only shot you have, make the most of it. I don't know. I don't think it takes away anything. I think it adds, if we talk about it correctly. But of course, I recognize that some people require that safety blanket. And look, my purpose is not to kill people's beliefs, but to just get them to realize how amazing the real universe really is.
If you can hold on to those beliefs and still have the type of wonder and the type of excitement coupled with the scientific literacy that allows you to appreciate what we now know, what modern science has afforded us to know, and you can still hold on to those religious beliefs, good for you.
I know some people who do. I don't understand how they do.
I don't understand it either. They seem to make it work.
As long as it doesn't get in the way. My problem actually is the following. If it really didn't have any impact at all, fine. But believing false things ultimately produces irrational actions, be it deciding that gay marriage is wrong, or you pick your favorite thing. And so what worries me, if religious belief were completely innocuous, I wouldn't have any problem with it. But, you know, it leads to irrational actions and irrational decisions. And it's not just religious beliefs. Anytime your beliefs conflict with the evidence of reality, you're going to make bad decisions. If you look out your window and decide you can walk out that window because it looks nice, well, you're going to have a serious problem.
Yeah.
And nature's going to tell you about it pretty quickly. And if we insist on not believing in climate change because we don't like the idea, we'll have to deal with that.
So I know that you want to go, and you mentioned climate change, and that reminded me, mostly because it's a very common answer. At the end of my podcast, I always ask my guests two questions, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering what your answers are to these two questions.
Let's see.
I'm wondering if I can predict them. So the first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that keeps you up most at night? What is the thing you're most concerned about? But on the flip side of that, what are you most excited about? What do you look forward to? And don't give me a nihilistic answer.
No. I'm excited every day by being surprised by the universe. I mean, that's why I do science. It's not because I think I understand it. It's because the universe continues to surprise me. Obviously, I'd like to understand the nature of dark energy. I'd like to know if we live in the only universe, if the laws of nature, if they were changed of one iota, would the whole thing fall apart? Or is our universe just one of many universes with different laws of physics? These are fundamental and profound questions that I would love to know the answer to.
And is that what keeps you up at night, trying to figure out those answers?
In the best nights, I'm kept up with happy worries about wondering about how we might resolve those things. And sometimes mm-hmm. I come up with potential answers and write them down. Obviously, I worry about the human condition. I certainly see no evidence that humanity is prepared to deal with the global challenges of the 21st century. And I fully expect we'll have to deal with the consequences. I'm not a nihilist. I don't think that's the end of the world, but I think, you know, there are going to be consequences we're going to have to live with. And
we are,
and
we're
global warming
to
is
live
going to
them.
Happen, whether we like it or not,
it
because we're not doing anything about it.
Yes.
And we are going to have to mediate it. But I also think we could have some technological fixes for certain aspects of it that are at least going to mediate. It's going to create incredible geopolitical problems, especially for the poor nations, the people who never produced the damn problem in the first place. Which really, in some sense, upsetting. I mean, in a store, if you break it, you fix it. We broke it.
Exactly.
It's our moral obligation, if you believe in morality at any level, to fix it. And it's a sad situation that I think we're not going to, and we're going to have to deal with the consequences. We'll maybe muddle through. But one of the reasons I talk about this stuff it would be great if we could globally respond for the first time in any way, but the carbon's up there, and I don't see. We need to think about removing it, and anyway, we'll deal with those consequences, those geopolitical consequences, maybe we'll have to deal with it the hard way.
Well, and we will need to, because we are human, and being human, there is some amount of separation from what we talk about as being nature. Obviously, we're made of nature. We live
in
nature.
We can change it. We have amazing capabilities.
We have morality. We have ethics.
Well,
we have...
I don't know if we do or not. I don't know what morality
is. I guess we fancy that we do. We are not the way that we think of nature as being somewhat cruel and somewhat random. We actually have the ability to make decisions
We can make changes.
Exactly.
We can respond
purposefully
to problems, and I expect we will. Certain problems like water. Desalinization, I think, is a problem that can be solved.
Mm-hmm. Which will revolutionize things.
Yeah, I think it will be. There are lots of problems we'll solve. I have great faith that we'll come up with technologies that will mediate some aspects of the problem. But there's going to be a lot of pain, and mm-hmm. I'm sad about that. But, you know, as my good friend Cormac McCarthy, who wrote the copy-edited my book, Quantum Man, you know, who's a very dark writer, But I was very honored that he asked to copy edit. I mean, that book. When I first met him, he was a very cheerful guy, and I was surprised because he writes very dark books like The Road and No Country for Old Men and stuff. And I said, you know, I'm surprised you're so cheerful. And he said, well, I'm a pessimist, but that's no reason to be gloomy. And that's my attitude.
I love it. So if you go back to this macro place, What's your perfect universe? Is your perfect universe a multiverse? Do you fancy?
I don't have a perfect universe. My perfect universe. I just want to know how the universe works.
And you never think about the way you wish it did work.
Of course, I think about that to some extent, but I'm enough of a scientist to know that what I want is irrelevant. The universe doesn't give a damn about what I want.
It's irrelevant to the universe, but it's not irrelevant to the people
listening. No, I want to know. I just want to understand the universe. I don't want the universe to be the way I want it to be. I want to understand the way it really is.
So therefore, the way you want it to be is not something you're going to share.
No. I mean, you know, I want myself to be the center of the universe, but it's not going
to
happen.
Hey, well, it does appear that way to us, doesn't it? It appears that way.
We all appear that. We all want that. Actually, I'm not sure I want that either.
Well, because of inflation.
There are times when I am, and it seems like I am, and it's embarrassing.
Because of inflation, in some ways, in a really tangible sense, it does appear that we are in the center of the universe.
Well, I don't know. What I like to say about the universe
is that
every place is the center of the universe. And so,
what a wonderful place to live.
You know, it's either, you can choose, like, half full or half empty. Either no place is the center of the universe, or every place is the center of the universe.
We all get to be the center.
But I really try not to second guess the universe. I mean, I make proposals, and I've made beautiful proposals, and the universe hasn't been smart enough to adopt them. So that's the way it goes.
I think that is a brilliant way to live. It's a brilliant way to work, especially doing what you do, which is so important.
Well, I try.
Because we do trust you, and you know, people are people, and people are fallible.
I try to be at least, and this is going to sound self-serving, but I try at least to be trustworthy. I believe, especially since I happen to have a public voice, more public than many, and I'm honored by that, to not knowingly misinform. And that's my main purpose in educating, or at least popularizing. You know, sure, I misinform at some level because you approximate with words, mathematics, but
so
I try to never knowingly misinform. And,
sure.
And that's my, if I had one mantra, that's it.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end it. Thank you so much, Dr. Krause, for taking time out of your party schedule. That's all this man does. He just parties all the time.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. No, that's not true, I hope. But anyway, thank you, and it's a pleasure to be up here.
Absolutely wonderful. And guys, I look forward to the next time that we get together to talk nerdy.
Me too.